to order the House Audit Committee on Audit and Human Service Budget Reform. Today is Wednesday, February 12th, and we are pleased at our informational meeting to have Barney Spate, Director of Government Relations for Kaiser Permanente Health Plan. He's going to make a presentation on developing a new framework for the Oregon Health Plan. In addition to that, towards the end of his remarks, I think Barney will give us a brief overview of the informal work groups, the progress that we made in establishing those that relates to health plan, mental health delivery systems, as directed by all four substantive chairs of the health policy, as well as Ways and Means Chair Winters. Mr. Spate.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Welcome.
For the record, Barney Spate with Kaiser Permanente. I believe I gave staff copies of my handout. And I indicated to staff I'll also send an electronic copy so that additional copies can be made available to the public, for those that didn't receive them. I appreciate the invitation to appear here today, and I put on the first handout, first page of my handout, Kaiser Permanente et al., because I think I'm here not just because I represent Kaiser Permanente, but because of my history with the Oregon Health Plan over the last 10 years, and more specifically that I served for 3 years at the Office of Health Plan Policy and Research from 1996 to 1999. So in addition to my private sector perspective, I did have the good fortune to participate in state government with the Oregon Health Plan at the policy level. So with that caveat, I appreciate being here. I'd also like to point out to the committee that I encourage you to stop me as we go along for questions. I know you will. I just get myself ready for that.
Representative Cruz is committed to the entire committee. He's only going to ask 33 questions today.
He only gave me 12 of them in advance. page 2, I hope this outline catches the main thrusts of what I was kind of asked to cover, and then spend a little bit of time, as I did in the Senate Health Policy Committee, talking about the past, what was the goal of the Oregon Health Plan when it was conceived and developed over several years in the late 80s and early 90s. What are the components of the Oregon Health Plan? Because when we talk about that in this group or in other committees in this building, there are several components, and it's good to know that the word has interchangeable meanings. And sometimes it's good to ask, when you say the OHP, what do you mean? What are you talking about? The chair and staff also thought it would be good to go quickly over some of the OHP2 waiver, the most recent history of the Oregon Health Plan, and what the changes were brought about through the waiver. Then I'd like to spend a few minutes comparing and contrasting today with the early days, the late 80s and the 90s, about what's changed and how has the environment changed, and therefore the policy environment and the fiscal environment in which you find yourselves, in which we find ourselves, because we're all in this together. And then I'd like to conclude with some thoughts, and these are just my personal ruminations of trying to establish not an answer. I don't come here with answers today. I think the answers are going to be found through a lot of bright minds working together. But to talk about some of the tools, the policy tools or approaches to think about, and perhaps processes or frameworks to think about how we might look at the challenge that we have lying ahead of us. And as I said, Q&A is encouraged. So, Mr. Chair, I hope that covers it, and the Q&A will clearly pick up those things that I missed. I'm on page 3 now. The goal of the OHP is actually in ORS. At 414-018, it states that the intention of the Legislative Assembly was to achieve the goals of universal access to an adequate level, high-quality health care at an affordable cost. This goal is a pretty big goal. And in the late 80s and in the early 90s, many of us who were involved then and have stayed involved in the generations that have followed us, at the time we thought that this was an attainable goal. And I think one of the questions of the current environment is to go back to a premise and ask, is that goal at the state level possible, particularly under the current federal-state partnership known as Medicaid? And later in my testimony, we can talk more about it. But the important point at this point in my testimony, Mr. Chair, is just to point out that the intention in the late 80s and early 90s was a pretty big step. And there were at least one paper was written talking about the states who could not wait. And Oregon was one of five or six states that moved aggressively into trying to find ways to build on employer-sponsored insurance using the Medicaid program. And, of course, Medicare is always with us for the elderly. How we could put all those together and frame it at the state level to, if not reach universal access, to come close to it. The goal of the Oregon Health Plan at the time and was backed up with some legislative findings, and I think most of these findings remain true today. Significant public and private expenditures are made in healthcare, and I think all of the background, the excellent overview that you have all received in the last couple of weeks from various perspectives have just driven home the substantial role that healthcare plays in contemporary society and the cost that it plays in both public sector and the private sector. The legislative finding in ORS continues to say that the state has an interest in assisting Oregon businesses and individuals to obtain insurance or coverage of necessary basic health care insurance services. That it is a role of government. I think it was intended at the time that the Oregon Health Plan would be a public-private partnership. As I said, I think it was intended from the get-go to build off the employer-sponsored sector of health insurance coverage and link it with a new approach to Medicaid. Third findings, the lack of basic health care coverage is detrimental to health, that is to an individual health. It's also detrimental to the public health and to the economic development. I think, again, you've gotten lots of overviews that continues to confirm that legislative finding is true, and I think that a lot of the concerns expressed in the public are best fall under that bullet. The fourth bullet is an interesting one for us to consider, and that is managed health care systems have potential to reduce the cost of health care. Clearly, this was, you can pretty much tell that this was written prior to 2001, 2002, in the post-Clintonian era of where managed care was, in fact, the primary strategic thrust of both the public sector and the private sector. And a lot has changed in the intervening 10 years in this state relative to managed care. We still have a substantial portion of Oregon Health Plan Medicaid enrollees in managed Medicaid. The managed Medicaid system is alive. It's clearly not as healthy as it was, and I think tomorrow you'll hear some other perspectives from those that are more involved in the fully capitated health plans to let you know its current state. So I don't want to portray it as dead or even dying, but I do think that the overall environment of managed care, when you look at the public sector and the private sector, has changed from the late 80s and early 90s. In the late 80s and early 90s, we actually saw expansions of managed care organizations in the commercial sector throughout this state into rural and even frontier areas that I thought at the time I would never see happen in my lifetime. What has happened is we've also subsequently seen a contraction of that managed care in the commercial sector for many of those communities, not just rural, but urban communities in the southern part of the state. So I think there's a question mark on this bullet in my mind about what will the role of managed care be in the future. And I think there will continue to be a role in both the public and private sector. I think it's being redefined. It's not so much networks and primary care physicians and referrals and all of that, but a whole new sense of how you manage care. evidence-based medicine, information systems that will allow physicians and other caregivers to exchange information and be more effective. All of those, I think, will be part of the 21st century definitions. Page five, the Oregon Health Plan, and most people, when you ask most citizens, there were some surveys done back in the mid-80s about what do you think of the Oregon Health Plan, and everyone said they loved it, but then tried to define it, they had a difficult time defining it. But there is a formal definition of the Oregon Health Plan also in statute. And on page five, the components of the Oregon Health Plan that are in statute currently are the 8 bills that were passed between 1987 and 1993. I don't want to spend a lot of time here, but to say the following. You can see that there was a component, the Insurance Pool Governing Board, and Rocky King gave you a good history of that. Senate Bill 27 dealt with the Health Services Commission, the prioritized list, the Medicaid waiver, Senate Bill 534 with OMIP, the insurance high-risk pool, Senate Bill 935, pay and play, also known as the employer mandate, what was passed in 89. The assumption of Senate Bill 935 was always that some sort of ERISA waiver would have to be gotten to make pay or play work, and that was never achieved, and therefore the pay or play portion of the Oregon Health Plan, that is universal coverage by expanding employer-based coverage through a mandate, never came to fruition. In 1991, just before we applied for the waiver in 1992-93 and was approved in 94, so Senate Bill 44 refined some of the statutory provisions of the forthcoming waiver. And then in 1991, we were working on small group reform, so we were trying to make health insurance through the small group more available to overcome some of the system impediments that existed. And I think Rocky covered those with you pretty well. Also created was the Health Resources Commission through 1077. And I served for 4 years as a citizen member on the Resources Commission. And it was created at the time to play a role in assessing technology. Of how are new technologies going to impact both the cost and quality of care? How should new technologies be rolled out and diffused, if you will, through the state? Its role has changed over the years substantially, and really its technology role never really came to a lot of fruition. But it was a recognition at the era of when we were putting the OHP together is that the technological forces that were driving American healthcare and the costs that are related to those were a significant issue for us to understand and for the healthcare community to understand. And then lastly, in 1993, there was 5530, which really gave the implementation go-ahead. And OHP, the Medicaid portion of the OHP, was actually implemented in April of 1994. And it created the Office of Health Plan Policy and Research, which was an office intended to stand somewhat between the legislature and the executive branch, looking at the various executive, the administrative agencies that were charged with implementing the new OHP. And to be able to comment on and give policy direction to both the legislature and the governor. On page six, there are some other components that are not in the statute. You've heard a lot about the Family Health Insurance Assistance Program, but I consider it to be part of the Oregon Health Plan. It came after the statutes and the programs that I cited earlier. It was actually authorized in 1997 after a successful November 1996 vote that raised tobacco taxes and dedicated to the Oregon Health Plan. And this, of course, as you've learned, is dedicated to a different form of this overall goal of public-private partnership in that it focuses on the private sector but using public sector premium share, subsidization of premiums, both in the group and the individual market. I'd also note that we went for several years with FEOP being a state-funded program only, no federal match. And the great achievement, and I'll get into when I get into OHP 2, is to come out of the waiver, one of the great steps forward to be able to make the FEOP program, healthier over the long haul, was to be able to get some federal match for its mission so that it wasn't only state-funded. There are other components. If you talk to other folks that have been around the development of the Oregon Health Plan over the last 10 or 12 years, they probably could hear other pieces of legislation that they would put on the mix of what makes up the Oregon Health Plan. I put down one, for example, in 1999, the Patient Protection Act, maybe it was 2001, the Patient Protection Act was passed after a year of a collaborative work by all of the parties that were interested in this. A piece of legislation was brought to the legislature. They really put in at the state level the patient protection that the federal debate has never answered. The point, I think, out of all of this when we talk about the Oregon Health Plan is it was multidimensional. It looked at the private sector. It looked at the public sector. But clearly the public sector piece that is in everybody's mind today is, in fact, what I call the OHP Medicaid program. The reforms of the Medicaid program, the prioritized list, the use of federal or fully capitated health plans, and then of course the expansion of the eligibles beyond the categorical eligibles that are in the classic federal-state Medicaid partnership. What's changed since 1994? And I picked 1994 because February 1 of 1994. The Oregon Health Plan Medicaid reforms were launched, and new eligibles were enrolled. In the course of the following few months, within 6 to 9 months, I think we were up to about 125,000 new lives were enrolled in Oregon's Medicaid program. Most of these you've probably already heard in some detail or other, but I always look backwards to understand. To understand where we are today, I have to think about where I found myself 10 years ago. Clearly, the economy and the fiscal conditions of the state have changed dramatically. We were working, when we were crafting to put the Oregon Health Plan together, we were working in an era of expanding employment, declining unemployment, expanding revenue bases for the state, for all government, and the fascinating thing, we look back now, health insurance, employer-sponsored health insurance, was actually growing and was one of the major components of eliminating or lowering, not eliminating, lowering the uninsurance rate, because the employment market was so tight that health insurance became a tool for retention and recruitment and retention. We had growing tax revenues that we thought, along with the other combinations of policy and system attributes, that the tax revenues would grow at a rate that could sustain the funding of the Oregon Health Plan over time. That leads to the second bullet, and I would point you to a graph that immediately follows page 7 because it's in my mind a pretty good 40-year picture of healthcare costs that was taken out of a Kaiser Family Foundation report, but it actually comes from a health affairs article called "The Sad History of Healthcare Cost Containment as Told in One Chart." This one chart kind of reflects at least 30 of the 40 years I've been involved in. So many of us have ridden up and down these waves, but it's the rate of increase in healthcare costs. You can see that in the mid to late 80s, healthcare costs were declining markedly. In fact, in 1983, 1983, the federal government implemented DRGs. Margaret Heckler was Secretary of HHS at the time, and she indicated at the time that the back of healthcare inflation was broken by the implementation of DRGs in the Medicare program. She left soon after that, and you can see there was a spike in the mid-80s, but then they declined again. Managed care, talk of federal reform, et cetera. And now we are back really on the other side of that valley. and you've heard from others the rapid increases of healthcare spending, their implications on the private sector and on the public sector, and probably the most significant aspect in public funding of healthcare, that as costs increase in the private sector in the delivery system, physicians, hospitals, pharmaceuticals, durable medical equipment, whatever the input costs to healthcare are, as those costs increase, there is pressure on state government to, at least while its funding has never been at a level that the providers are happy with, the pressure really increases because the state falls farther and farther behind to be able to fund those increased costs. Again, I mentioned the impact of employer-sponsored insurance, and you've heard from Rocky and others about what rising health care costs have done to the private sector.
Excuse me.
And then this issue.
Barney,
yes.
Question? Yeah, before you get on that chart, just in your opinion, given that this is somewhat of a pattern of up and down, do you foresee, for example, at 8.1 rising much further and then dropping again, kind of a trend here, or are there other variables at work that might not bring this down?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Berkovian, there is a phenomena in health insurance called the six-year cycle, 3 years up, 3 years down, and many a good or even not so good underwriter or actuary with a health insurance company has made or lost his or her career based upon where they are in the cycle. There is a cyclical nature that is really, to the extent that I'm not a professional in this by any means, but I've asked actuaries over the course of my life, why is there a six-year cycle? And it's really inexplicable. And it's primarily, there's a pattern of healthcare use that's up and down. They've tried to link it to the business cycle and other phenomena. So there is some cyclicality in the use of healthcare services. There are also, I think, federal and state policy plays a lot both in the upward spikes and the downward troughs. One is, I was advised long, long time ago not to prognosticate about this, but I'll give you my opinion. I think there will be a plateau because I think, quite candidly, we can't sustain for 5, 6, 7 years double-digit inflation in either the public sector or the private sector. There will be a plateauing. But my guess is that what's on the other side of that plateau will be somewhat different because the underlying environment and demographics are different than those earlier years. We are really confronting the baby boom, and I'm in the first year of the baby boom. And I've talked to, for example, some orthopedists that have done some analysis of work at Kaiser, and watching the intensity of orthopedic procedures just as the mean age of our groups move from 35 to 45, the number of orthopedic procedures goes up. In fact, it's interesting, the number of procedures goes up, and at 65 they go down. So there's a lot of tennis elbow and knees and other things that are taken care of just prior to going on Medicare. So this bolus of the demographics of the baby boom is not reflected in any of these statistics. And the discouraging part for particularly somebody my age at 57 is that I was hoping that out of all my work over 25 years, some of this would be solved so that when I got to be 65, there'd be something there. I'm more and more skeptical about whether we're going to be able to do that. That's one factor that's different from the past. The other factor that's not different from the past relative to its qualitative nature, but may in fact be to in its quantitative nature, is the whole impact of technology in healthcare. If we go back into the 60s, particularly the troughs in the mountains in the 60s and through the 70s, we had technological advances, but we did not have technological advances like we've seen, particularly in the last 10 years. And what they're looking out into the future with regarding particularly genetic engineering, a whole array of new non-invasive types of surgeries. I'll give you one example. I find astounding. My brother-in-law had a total knee replacement, transplant, a prosthesis. It was inserted into his knee through a 3-inch incision. He went into the hospital at 7 in the morning. He stayed overnight. They had him walking 3 hours after a hip. They had him walking. The hip's even worse. They had him walking 3 hours after he came out of OR recovery, and he was home 24 hours later, walking on crutches. He lives in Southern Oregon. He drove home 7 days later.
It was the wrong hip, though.
It was the right hip.
No.
But the point being is that, and this was an experimental procedure. He was part of a pilot group. But they are doing minimally invasive prosthetic replacement of joints with prosthesis with very minimally invasive surgery and with very rapid, fast turnaround times. That's wonderful. It makes it so much easier for if the patient qualifies. But it's the kind of technological innovation that changes what a hospital is and also, to some degree, changes the demand curve relative to the acceptance of these procedures, because a lot of people didn't have hip procedures done because they knew that there was a very long recovery time. Oftentimes, the recovery was very painful. These are all advances that make the technology more accessible. I'm not saying it's good or bad. It's just a reality of how I think the world is different. It's a very it's an excellent question, because I think it's the kind of question that we're going to have to manage through and be cognizant of. I've also talked and what's changed the role of managed care. I touched upon that earlier. In fact, some of the most we've seen a retreat of HMO enrollment, retreat of HMOs covering portions of the state. There still is managed care in service benefit plans like Regents and Blue Cross Blue Shield, with PPOs and new forms of management. But the classic managed care of the 90s has clearly changed. And I think from the public sector point of view, and I'll get into this a little bit when we start talking about the future of OHP, is that managed care only works, and excuse this metaphor, if you got enough gasoline in the tank to drive the car. Because what you're asking in managed care is that you transfer the risk from one party to another, and that ultimately there needs to be enough fuel to drive that car, whoever's driving it, or they're going to go bust. Whether it's the insurance company or a group of physicians that are taking risk through an insurance company. And when we get into the cost squeezes where revenues, whether they be public or private, aren't rising as fast as costs, then I think it becomes harder and harder for particularly provider-driven organizations to assume that kind of risk, which raises questions about the long-term sustainability, at least risk-bearing type of managed care. I also put down that what's changed is that I think we walked into the Oregon Health Plan thinking that the federal-state partnership, small p, was different than what it actually ended up being. And I think you've heard a lot, and particularly those of you who have been here a couple of sessions, know the frustration as a state policymaker of the difficulty of moving the line. There were really two assumptions when we put the Oregon Health Plan together of how do you control the costs, and Senator Minnis reminded me of this when I spoke to the Senate committee, and that is, one was that the legislature could have confidence that the movement of the line to confront the economics of a current environment would happen and could happen, and it really it happened with in a minimal way, and really was not the tool that we thought it was going to be. The other was the role of managed care, that both the moving of the line and managed care would be the cost checks, the cost management aspects to get us through periods where cost growth was perhaps higher than revenue growth. Both of those we've learned weren't there to the extent that we thought they were going to be. Therefore, they were kind of tools that we didn't get to use as much as we thought we could. I've talked to you about the spending per capita and the ups and downs. The next graph I just put in because from a, whether you're a state policymaker or a CEO of a company or an individual buying health insurance, if the top line, which is the cost increases of health insurance premiums, continuously stays above the line of workers' earnings, overall inflation, growth in the general fund. Put in any. I've done the line for every boss I've ever worked for. I've done a chart like this because it comes down to at some point something's got to give because there are other functions of government, other priorities of government than health care. It can't consume all of the general fund. Business has to spend its dollars not just on health care or employee benefits. And this is the cost challenge that all of us have over the long haul of trying to get the cost of health care, the increase. When I talk about controlling health care costs, it's basically controlling the increase in the health care costs. That is, if we could get them in line, if we could run a decade where the health care increase, the medical CPI, was somewhere around 1.25 to 1.5 of the CPI, we could probably manage this thing. But if, when it's growing 2 and 3 and 3+ times the CPI, it's a real challenge to whoever the payer is. In the 2001 session, I'm on page 8 now. And there was initial talk in the 1999 session. The whole issue of the sustainability, because in 97, 99, 2001, we began to see the world change. We began to see the commercial market and managed care. We began to see cost increases in the private sector. Pressures for cost increases through the Oregon Health Plan. And so a rising discussion was how is this going to be sustainable? And the 2001 session basically tackled that.
Barney, let me interrupt you. It goes back to your statement reflection on if we could just keep medical inflation within 1.5 points of the CPI, we could get our arms around this beast. Recently, Pricewaterhouse came out with their, and I don't know the official name, but their medical inflation / utilization index. And it's pegged right at 25%. How much of that is utilization and how much is medical inflation?
I'm going to give you a Kentucky windage, so don't hold me to this. I'd say it's about 40-60. It's probably about 40% cost input and about 60% utilization.
It's probably fairly close.
And plus or minus 10 or 15. And again, that's just intuition. I'm assuming that we could probably look at that, and there are other indexes like that other national brokerage firms do that trail that, and we could probably get that.
The federal government uses.
Yeah, right.
This isn't just some special interest group or somebody else out there.
Over the last couple of years, utilization has, when I talk to people in private health plans, including Kaiser, utilization is high. And there's a lot of questions about why that's high. Part of it is an aging population. Not all of it, in fact, relatively small part. We didn't age that much in 2 or 3 years. Part of it is the cyclicality. If you've been through the 2001
session, a great deal in 2002, I can assure you.
Yeah. Part of it is new technology. Part of it is the cyclical nature of healthcare consumption. Part of it is, I believe, and again, this is personal opinion, pent up demand from the managed care years when health inflation was low. I think two things happened. I think partly the system suppressed both provider-driven demand and consumer-driven demand. And there's two kinds of demand. There are procedures that may be on the in the gray area that do no harm but may do some good that providers will order that in a managed care environment didn't make it through, or maybe they have more to ask. There are also consumer-driven demand. The best example is the consumer-driven demand about federal legend drugs that are advertised. But there are people who want a knee surgery so they can play tennis at 65. So both are out there happening, and that would be my long-winded answer. They both play a role, and I think when I first came up here at your behest, I said that the basic rule I always look at as a layman is look at the cost per unit and then the number of units. And that's the cost, and the whole health care premium is just the sum of that, using the old sum thing. And they're both in play, so to speak.
Yeah, I mean, they're obviously interrelated. I mean, incidence use and additional cost per incidence, I understand that. The other way to say what you were saying, relative to your whatever the inflation, the CPI is now, I mean, 1-2%, we're 8-10 points over that for medical inflation.
Yes, and you're right, Mr. Chairman, and I would point out that when the inflation, when these cost increases, and if this was a chart of not spending per capita, but the increases in the medical CPI, it would look pretty close to this, not exact, but the medical CPI back in the mid-90s trailed almost for a couple of years right at the CPI. It was one of the first times in my lifetime that it had ever gotten down. It may have been 1.1, maybe 1.2. I don't think it ever actually went lower than the general CPI, but it trailed along there for a while, and that was, you know, that was, there were some that were applauding a la the Margaret Heckler line I gave earlier. You know, we've broken the back of healthcare cost increases, and of course, you know, that's why we all get to live longer probably than we ought to, so we learn more.
Yeah, one of those pesky little human things, we want to live longer. Representative Bates.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Apologize for being late. We had a couple of sick House members upstairs. Something about a vote this morning.
Only a couple?
Yeah.
Hey,
dying the streets there. Marty, I'd like to get into this conversation a little bit tighter if we could, because I think it's something that obviously affects the Oregon Health Plan, but our entire health care system, the incredible inflation we're seeing now in health care costs. I want to get into a couple pieces of it. Other countries are also seeing inflation in health care costs, but not to the level that we are. I've talked to Canadians as an example, and they're seeing inflation too, and they're very concerned about it. But when they give me their figures, I'm thinking, I'd love to have those figures, okay?
Yeah.
There's some things that are unique to our system that have not been discussed in this room, and I'd like to have you flesh them out for me if you could a little bit. And I'm going to mention a couple of them here real quick. One, we have a tremendous amount of technology available to the public, and the public knows about it. So when someone comes in and has a bad knee, they want an MRI, and they demand an MRI. And the effect of that is that most physicians are going to give them that MRI because they don't want to get sued later if something is missed. And so they move immediately to an MRI. You don't wait 2 or 3 weeks to see if the knee gets better. You immediately get an MRI. I mean, that's an example of what goes on and goes on across the board. The other issue in America is that we have a preponderance of subspecialists and a limited number of primary care physicians, which is the flip side of what most countries have. They have a large number of primary care, small number of subspecialists. We know that subspecialty care drives health care costs for the reasons I've just spoken to. And we know that's another driver for this thing. We have exceptionally high prescription costs. But the thing is driving, I think, our inflation right now, more than anything else, is hospitalization costs. We have a huge amount of duplicated services in our communities. I don't think anybody goes to one hospital or another based on, I checked all the prices at the rooms and checked in the one that was the cheapest. We go where we're sent as a patient. We haven't got time to make a decision. And those duplicated services are probably expensive for us also. Inside our hospitals, we have rooms and places that look better than my home, which may speak to my home, but in many countries, you'll be in a ward with 5 or 6 other patients. In many areas of our country now, it's private rooms, which frankly are not good for patient care because your nurse can't see what's going on. They have private rooms, private TVs, cable television, and gourmet meals, which is expensive. And those kind of demands by the public are driving the health care costs up, too. Could you comment on some of those issues real quickly for us?
Mr. Chairman, Dr. Bates, I'd be happy to try to
bring breakfast for us.
Try to respond. At the top of your list was technology, and clearly, again, as a kind of a layman in health policy, Americans consume technology much earlier in the technological curve and much faster than other countries. We like technology. Our providers like technology. We as patients like technology, and it is, quite candidly, a significant industry in this country, biomedical technology development is a growth industry. in part because we're a great test market before you take it to the rest of the world. One of the issues about old technology and new technology that was one of the hopes of the Health Resources Commission is to understand, because in healthcare, in most technologies, if you look at most other economic sectors, people are amazed that technology doesn't drive down the cost in healthcare, because in other sectors, technology usually improves productivity and really lowers the cost of product. In healthcare, it's just absolutely the opposite. And one of the conclusions I've come to is that we have a very long learning curve in this country about how to use new technologies. And so we introduce new technologies. They are a companion with old technologies. We use them both, and it usually takes, in the practice of medicine around the country, about 8 to 10 years before the literature starts to say, no, you don't use X for this. It's not that effective. You use it over here. But we've had this long learning curve because we get the technologies out into the environment very quickly. They get paid for very quickly. They get used. And then we learn about them. And quite candidly, in other countries, they really like, I think, for us to test all this stuff, because then when it goes to Great Britain or Germany or France, they may be a few years behind, but the evidence base of how to use the technology is more refined, and therefore it's adapted into the medical armamentarium in a more cost-effective way. There are also lots of technologies, quite candidly, and there's a fair amount of literature in the health and economics about this, is that the added value that they give to the health outcome is very small given the input price. And it takes us a long time. So if you think of an added value curve, you get to a point up in the top of this curve is that one more dollar of added value doesn't get you a dollar worth of added value as far as health outcome. We don't know a lot about that, and it takes us a long time to learn about that. And I'll give you one example, and this is a Kaiser Permanente example. Because we have an automated medical record where all of 700 of our physicians and all the rest of the clinicians basically have embedded into the automated medical record system guidelines about how to use new technologies. Because of that, and the guidelines are written by the specialists that Dr. Bates talked about, because of a guideline written into our technology that told primary care physicians and others, PAs, nurse practitioners, when to order, when an MRI might be appropriate versus a CT scan, we have actually changed the mix of the number of MRIs versus the CTs ordered. And a CT is cheaper than an MRI, but in many clinical cases, it will give the diagnosing physician the information he or she wants. The guidelines were not written by primary care. They were written by a radiologist, and they happen to be guidelines that are national guidelines. So to the extent that systems of care, and they can be an HMO system like Kaiser, or they could be an IPA system at a community level, to the extent that those guidelines become embedded into medical practice, you can manage the use of technology more effectively. And this technology does occur, and Dr. Bates is right about the issue of defensive medicine. And I guess one of the points that I would make about defensive medicine, the defensive medicine due to malpractice, and also because I think we underinvest in this country in what I call evidence-based medicine, and that is being able to tell physicians fairly rapidly what's the best accepted standard of care for a treatment. And the more doubt that there is, the more vagueness there is about this, then I think the more physicians find themselves, because of the nature of our litigious society, is that they've got to cover their behind, and they've got to make sure that everything is done that they can defend themselves with. Whereas if we have a good evidence base that can be used, and the standard of care is much more explicit and accepted, then I think the bell-shaped curve of practice becomes, it's a wider bell-shaped curve. If you know what I'm trying to explain. Subspecialist primary care, I can't disagree with you. We are having specialty shortages in some subspecialties, but we clearly don't look at like the other countries in the Western industrialized world regarding the mix of primary care. I don't even think when you throw in nurse practitioners and PAs and other physician extenders. So our cost should be more because of that. I would put the RX under the technology, and everything I said about technology I would ditto for RX, with one exception, and that is the prescription drug technology is different in this sense, is that we're closer to it as consumers, and therefore we're much closer. However, if you pick up any newspaper now in almost any city, there's open MRIs that are advertising also. So what I was going to say about the accessibility of prescription drugs and our ability as consumers to want to be thinking about what we want to take is a little different than some of the surgical technologies that I was talking about. Hospital costs. They are, in fact, in some recent surveys, hospital costs now are number one, and RX, the cost of RX, are number two. I don't know. I will disclose, just so that everybody that doesn't know me knows, I work for both the Oregon Medical Association, the Oregon Hospital Association, Blue Cross, Blue Shield, Kaiser Permanente. I think I've covered all the health ones, and Good Samaritan Hospital. So I've been around the block. I have friends in all of the industries. I haven't worked for pharma, but I have friends in the pharmaceutical industry too, I hope. The hospitalization costs, the increases that we're seeing today, I think are different than we've seen in the past. I'm not certain, Dr. Bates, that I would put a lot of value on the duplicated services. Most towns in Oregon have it's a one hospital town. I think probably that hospitals can be taken to task relative to following the hotel model. I don't know how much savings is there between a nice 2-inch carpet versus linoleum. But I've heard many people say that, you know, the hospitals are looking much more like a Class A hotel. I would put that in probably lower down the list. I think the drivers in hospital costs right now are probably at least three. One of them is new technologies that they need to acquire. The other is workforce issues of the incredible work, not just in nursing, and I know that the Cruises Committee and others in this legislature are going to be looking at the work, but almost every medical technical skill, radiology technologists, lab techs, medical assistants, RNs, there are major workforce shortages, which really propels the prices upward. It's supply-demand. And in many cases, hospitals are paying, just to be able to cover their acute care facilities, are paying extraordinary, flying people in and paying for them to live for 6 weeks in a hotel or an apartment and work for 6 weeks, pay them additional salaries, and then they leave. And I know there are major conversations going on with the administration about how hospitals and community colleges and the state government can help begin to solve that by getting more qualified students in the pipeline and trained, because I know there are hospitals out there that will hire them. And I want to say, just for the record, I have contributed a nurse to this. My daughter became a nurse in May of 2001, so the Spade family is trying to do, Dr. Bates, the most they can in this area.
And my foster daughter just graduated this spring. So
and she actually said she did it not for a job, but be able to take care of me when I'm senile. The other... We also find ourselves, I think, in an interesting historical time vis-a-vis hospitals, and that is, there is an aging cycle to hospital facilities, and so we are at a point 25, 30 years out from current facilities, where facilities either need to be renovated or renewed by new construction. A lot of the new construction that's going on in hospitals is not necessarily adding capacity, but it's replacing antiquated capacity. And I know Representative Anderson has seen that with in spades in Grants Pass with two good hospitals, both of them very aged as far as facilities, now being replaced by something that's much more contemporary. And that's a new cost. That's a new capital cost that's built into the prices. I think the other there's another. Excuse me. Okay.
Oh, if you're going to go on, I just had one question about hospitals. If you're going to move off that,
I'm not. I've got more to say about hospitals.
Okay. Well, let me just inject here. You might cover it. The kind of proliferation of satellite hospitals. It seems like every hospital has a number of satellites now. Has that added at all, you know, all the different infrastructures around a city to cost, in your opinion?
Chair Morgan and Mr. Berkovian, when you say satellite, do you mean hospitals that are in systems now as opposed to standalone hospitals or developing, say, like ambulatory surgery centers and...
Both ambulatory, and then sometimes they just have in a different section of the city a smaller hospital type of system. I know Salem has at least one over by the state hospital.
Oh, me. Okay. Well, actually, Mr. Chair, that in fact is the use of the Salem example is the use of what was long going way back. This was a two hospital town, and Salem Hospital purchased the hospital, and that campus is being used for other things. There is a fair amount of using of decentralizing on a hospital campus certain modalities of care that at one time we're all mushed together in acute care. And for example, behavioral health is oftentimes doesn't necessarily have to be offered, particularly outpatient behavioral health, doesn't have to be offered on campus. So there, through the specialization of hospitals, there's a fair amount of that. I can't speak in an informed sense. Is that a cost additive? It's usually more of a programmatic decision. One of the other changes in hospitals, not just in Oregon but throughout the country, is the systemization of hospitals, and that is of multiple hospitals in one state or one region being owned by a system, whether it be not-for-profit or for-profit, and oftentimes that is to be able to leverage capital, to leverage the back room works and things like that. The other... I may have lost my train of thought because I had one other thing I wanted to say about hospitals. But I've talked about the staffing.
I think you're going to comment on the gourmet food.
I've actually only been in an outpatient once in a hospital, but even gourmet food in a hospital I don't think is gourmet. So yeah, I know they try hard.
I'm a Kaiser member, believe me.
This is the first time I've ever heard the words gourmet food and hospital in the same sentence. Yeah. So I've learned something from Representative.
Amazingly, it does happen some places now.
A couple other things on hospital. One is the whole acuity level of hospitals. Hospitals have, in fact, because of the technology that I talked about earlier. It was said, in fact, a hospital administrator that I knew in Portland said about 10 years ago, he said, you know, in five to 10 years, a hospital is going to be nothing more than an intensive care unit. And while that's not specifically true, the metaphor is pretty close in the sense that the acuity of patients in hospitals is much more intense than it used to be because so much more now is done on an outpatient or even in the physician's office or on an ambulatory basis. So a hospital day today or a hospital admission today relative to acuity looks quite different than it did a decade ago. There's one other phenomenon. I've tried to be what I would call non-pejorative about hospitals. I will also, this may be viewed as somewhat pejorative, but I say it because I'm going to say it factually. Is that I think the market has changed relative to the buy-sell transaction in healthcare services. You go back 10 years ago, everybody believed that the world was going to be driven by managed care, that there would be systems of care. Physicians were concerned about whether they would actually have practices and should specialists merge. And so what happened in Portland, for those members from Portland, I don't know if you're almost all of the orthopedists got into one group. Now, since that, they didn't like each other when they were in separate groups. They got together for economic reasons, and now the world has changed, and they're now back into the separate groups. Primary care was going to play a whole new role in the management of health care, but primary care physicians and clinics generally are capital poor, so they were looking for new either capital partners or in some cases physicians would actually hire hospitals would hire physicians. So this whole era of how you bought healthcare services, and remember while I'm speaking of buying it, that would be the health insurance company that's negotiating with the rates for doctors and hospitals. That era has changed. We have a shortage of hospital beds in most communities. I received an email across, and I don't usually see this kind of stuff, but two or three weeks ago, every hospital in the city of Portland was full. Now, if you go back 10 years, when I represented hospitals, I would sit before a committee like this and they'd want to know why you got a 55% occupancy rate. Why aren't you merging or closing beds? So part of this is, in fact, a supply-demand issue. Now, that will be built into the prices and that will wash itself out over time, and that, I think that the plateau will come. There will be a plateauing of that because the those costs. So some of them are just going to be recognized as, you know, replacing aging facility, building new capacity. In the Portland metropolitan area, we're going to build our first new hospital. It's not in Oregon. It's going to be in Clark County, Washington. But the first new hospital built, I think, in 25 years. So we're adding capacity as opposed to taking capacity away. But to sum it up, Dr. Bates, all of those issues play at that cost utilization mix of what's driving. I think the third that's been talked about here as far as cost of hospital care, I have to say it, and that is federal and state reimbursement policies. There are implications. Now, we can argue about how big they are. Are they huge? Are they substantial? Are they small? But they're there. We know that there is underpayment, and then there, so there's somebody's going to pay more for somebody else's underpayment. Back to page 8. The issue behind the waiver was, as I put it there, seeking flexibility so that we could have sustainability. And I think you've probably all heard, I'll just very quickly go through, and then I've attached behind page 8, I thought this is an announcement that was actually sent out to OHP beneficiaries announcing the changes, give you a sense of what they saw, because what it relates to is the benefits were changed. It was a long, convoluted process of getting an OHP 2 benefit package. It left the prioritized list relative to the treatment condition pair, but it still followed a prioritization philosophy of building from the top. Instead of looking at condition treatment pairs, it looked at clusters of health services like hospital inpatient care, hospital outpatient care, physician care, and it quite candidly ranked those first by what Medicaid required, and then based upon what the Health Services Commission and the Waiver Application Steering Committee and lots of stakeholder input about what the most desirable services next, working their way down. So it was a prioritization, but it was not the prioritized list. With the idea being, and there's a bifurcation, when we started the Oregon Health Plan, it was every member of the Oregon Health Plan had the same benefit. And the new expansion eligibles, the people who had previously not been eligible for Medicaid because they didn't meet the categorical eligibility test, but they were still in poverty, they got the same benefit as the categoricals. The policy conundrum that we found ourselves in for years was that basically the federal government is very protective about the federal-state partnership relative to categoricals. They're much more flexible when we, as a state, said, okay, we'll treat the non-categoricals, the new expansion eligibles, differently. And so now we have some flexibility in benefit packages. And, in fact, on February 1 and then next month on March 1, we will actually be implementing that flexibility. There were increases to premiums and co-payments. These were also mentioned in the beneficiary newsletter. Eligibility was tied. There's a new, if you will, stick for remaining eligible, because if you don't pay your premium, you're actually disenrolled the month following your non-payment, whereas in the OHP Plus, if you don't pay your premium, you're not disenrolled till your six-month time is up. That was the old policy. It called for modest expansion, but it was supposed to be neutral. That was kind of the quid pro quo the feds had. We're not going to let you reduce the benefits without expanding. I often wonder if we had applied for the waiver now, would it be different, but so be it. And then, as I said earlier, another component of the waiver that I think was really an important step forward was getting federal match for FEOP, which really leveraged those funds and allowed more, particularly working adults, either group coverage or individual coverage. So the OHP2 waiver is now part of the history, part of the reality of the Oregon Health Plan, and I think it's part of the challenge that we're going to have to manage through over the next few months. I'd like you to look at page 10 before you look at page 9. I got these a little bit out of order. This is Barney's first law of healthcare economics. Now I'm transit, and there's nothing profound about this, so I love to write laws that aren't very profound. But if the annual cost increases, that is the rate of change, rise faster than the growth in revenues, and this is in healthcare, I don't care whether you're an employer, whether you're Medicare, whether you're Medicaid, whether you're an individual buying private health insurance, I think these forces are a given. Then the only way you're going to bridge that revenue cost gap is either reduce the benefits that are paid for, in the case of group coverage like Medicaid or an employer, number of persons who are eligible, how much you're going to pay for the services. Most of us in the commercial market look to our health carriers to take care of that. That is to negotiate with physicians and hospitals and others, or a combination of the above. And so when I get into the policy tools that are available, I want to put this in the context that I think our flexibility relative to what we can do is in fact limited to a pretty simple on the surface set of hydraulics, complex relative to the implications. Let me now go to back to page 9. And again, it's just a reiteration that I think what we will be looking at, and I've got a chart here I want to get to in a minute. In fact, maybe this is the best time. At near the end, I think the last two pages, there is this there's this little Barney's graph, my attempt to use draw and word.
I had an email that looked exactly like this.
Well, I tested it out on you, Representative Cruz.
Mine was a dark shade of gray.
And I think between the graph or the graphic and the policy tool statement, I think I can walk through this fairly quickly. But it's basically we're going to have to look at eligibility, and at the bottom of this graphic, I put the categoricals. That is, those individuals living in Oregon who qualify for the classic Medicaid. State Medicaid categorical program, which includes the aged, the blind, the disabled, pregnant women, children,
long-term care,
certain foster care, etc. Those categories we can get for you, but we're going to have to look at those eligibles. How many? What's the caseload look like in this state? I will just point out history. We haven't always funded Medicaid for the categoricals up to 100% of the poverty level. In fact, it's sometimes been between 50 and 75% of the poverty level. So one of the tests of vulnerability for even the categoricals will be how poor are you? Or are you less poor than your neighbor? So income can play a level. Now, under the current Oregon Health Plan, if you're under 100% of the poverty level, whether you're categorical or not, you get a benefit. So poverty level is a tool for looking at eligibility. But once you, I want to stay in the categorical now. So now you build up from that horizontal line, the covered benefits. There are certain benefits that the federal government requires states to provide in a state Medicaid program. Interestingly, the requirements are about as antiquated as the Medicare program. Physician hospital services, that's it, I think. There may be a couple others. RX is optional. There is no state in the union that has a Medicaid program that I'm aware of that doesn't have some prescription drug, but under the requirement of obtaining federal match, you don't even have to cover prescription drugs. So the issue, the point I'm trying to make on the graphic relative to the vertical line is that what's covered, the amount of benefits that are covered, are in fact a factor in how funds are expended and how much care is delivered. I'd stop here now because in one of the notes pages is that what's covered or the covered benefits has for the Oregon Health Plan and now for the Oregon Health Plan Plus has been a function of the prioritized list. I know there's been some discussion in this building and elsewhere about whether the prioritized list should be or continue to be a function of determining benefit levels. I think that there are certain concepts behind the prioritized list that I would call evidence-based medicine that, in fact, could be used in other models. That's going to be a policy choice. But I think perhaps even with the covered list, with the prioritized list, we need to look more at not just what's covered and what's not covered, but are there opportunities to have limited coverage? I'll give you one example. In most private sector coverages, there are limits on PT, physical therapy, occupational therapy, et cetera. And they're set generally relatively high to hit most of the need. But we haven't looked a lot at that kind of approach regarding covered benefits. So we've got some choices to make, again, on the categoricals on covered benefits. And the diagonal line going out on this graphic that gives this the three-dimensional, albeit my wife's an artist and she didn't marry one, you can all attest to that, is that another dimension to filling this three-dimensional box is going to be provider reimbursement levels. And if you can think about this as a three-part equation, the size of that box, both in a two-dimensional and three-dimensional size, either contracts or expands based upon the choices that are made along eligibility, covered benefits, and provider reimbursement. That's part of the task, because it says start at the bottom and work up. Some bodies in this room, or not in this room, in this building, are going to know, using a Kentucky windage at least, how much money is available to put in this whole box called the framework for considering the new health plan. You get above the dotted line after we answer the questions on the categoricals, then I think one of the next question is there are options that you're going to want. There are going to be scenarios for below the line because there's going to be a look at above the line of with what's left, how do we address the issues of non-categoricals? That is, in the current parlance, it would be the new eligibles under the OHP, those that are under 100% of the poverty level but who do not otherwise qualify for categorical aid. And I've thrown in here for just discussion purposes, even though it's a different policy debate, but it fits the same framework, and that's FIA, because there's state funds going with federal funds. And so you've got this whole issue of who, what the income levels are, what the covered benefits are, and what the provider reimbursement.
And, Barney, the other dynamic working here that the committee's got to consider always in these deliberations is if you don't address the non-categorical or standard PAC benefit eligibles, what happens, and that's obviously some form of shift, whether they present themselves to the physician's office or more likely to the most expensive care on the face of the planet, the emergency room, and how that impacts commercial / private insurance, and we continue down in the spiral.
In fact, I would point on page 11, and I'm kind of jumping around here.
Well,
I apologize
okay.
that, but I, you know, we can use all of this for a discussion. But I note in the last bullet that all of the choices that we will make, and again, you will make the choices, but there are going to be a lot of stakeholders that are going to be interested in and want to help you make those choices. You may be from the government here to help us, but we stakeholders are here to help you,
and
too.
We're going to appreciate it very much.
Is the last bullet, and that is the impact each of the choices, and particularly the consortium of choices that you make, are going to have differential impact on the private sector. And I think that's a function that we need to be very explicit about so that we understand what's happening. And I put two examples down there. One would be one, Mr. Chairman, you already mentioned, that's cost shifting. I note in my notes pages, the state in this session or in any session, I think this is a fair bet in my life, you're never going to eliminate cost shifting. But you can change how cost shifting impacts or where it impacts, or at least be knowledgeable or aware of how the cost shift plays out in the market. The other is the safety net. The safety net is both a public-private entity, but the choices that we make will either do, can, some could be, do more harm to the safety net, some could actually help the safety nets and us through this period. Eligibility, covered benefits, provider reimbursements. Using this, it's kind of an additive process. I also want to go back now to the last bullet on page 9, and that's delivery mechanisms. If you recall, I said early on about one of the changes in managed care was how risk can be transferred today versus 10 years ago. The current OHP fully capitated health plan model is a risk transfer model. The state transfers the economic risk for those that are in managed care to one of 14, 15 fully capitated health plans. They bear the risk, the economic risk, of the utilization cost equation that I've talked to you about. The state bears risk only at the eligibility level. The state's budget is built on a caseload, and so they've basically transferred much of the cost equation risk in healthcare to these downstream fully capitated health plans, and I put PCOs because that's an old model. That was another risk transfer model. A risk retention model is, in fact, a fee-for-service model. That is where the state is going to keep all the risk, not only the eligibility, the risk of eligibility and caseloads being higher than budget, but the risk that the utilization will be higher than budget. Now, I want to point out one thing just so that we're clear about it. The state is a unilateral buyer of health care services. There is no negotiation. The state sets the price, and it's either accepted or rejected. Blue Cross Blue Shield, when it enters into contracts with hospitals and physicians, Kaiser Permanente, when we enter into contracts with our physician group and with our community contracted hospitals, as much as my boss would love to have a unilateral price-setting mechanism, we don't. We negotiate. So the difference between a risk retention model and the state government is basically the state sets the price, and the provider community reacts to that price. The lower the price, probably the less robust the network of providers that are going to be willing to see Medicaid. Now that's particularly true for professional, physician, and other. It's not so true for hospitals. The hospitals take that price. But there's also a utilization risk that the state bears, is will utilization come out about the way we budgeted it? In the old days, before the Oregon Health Plan, a lot of the budget problems that the state had in the Medicaid program were either a derivative of we guessed the eligibility wrong, caseloads are up, or utilization's higher than we planned, hospital utilization, physician utilization, whatever, and so let's ratchet down the reimbursement to bring it back into adjustment.
Hold on half a second, Barney. Before Rick asks his question, I'd make a small observation, a nuance where the state sets the price, no negotiations. I would suggest that we are, through the committee process, we negotiate to some degree.
Mr. Chairman, I accept that. I accept that correction. There is a biennial
renegotiation or reevaluation of the status of the unilateral dictum from.
I agree with what you just said, and I would only use a metaphor to kind of clarify it even further.
Yes, sir.
Ford, when you decide to buy cars for the state motor fleet, it is a negotiated process too, but at some point Ford doesn't deliver cars to you if they don't like the price.
Yep, that's exactly right. Mm. Rick, and then Representative Bates.
Thank you, Chair. Barney, has it ever been attempted, or what's your thoughts on it, like a risk window? I think similar to what PEV has now done with mental health, if there's a 1% drop, state picks up a savings of 1% that is kind of recouped by the provider. Has that been attempted with, to your knowledge, with OHP? Is that a viable thing to consider nowadays with managed care?
Okay. Mr. Chairman, Mr. Bacobian, in fact, I think early in the OHP experience, when many of the FCHPs were that had formed primarily to serve the Medicaid population, there was, in fact, the state would share part of the risk, or there would be risk windows. And what Mr. Bacobian is referring to, instead of the plan taking on all of the economic risk relative to price and utilization, they would take on maybe most of it, but the state would be a reinsurer so that there would be some predictability, because many of these organizations that had formed for this business line. It was their sole business line. They had limited reserves. While they had to have reserves to get into the program, they were limited, and so they needed a period of time to be able to grow their reserves, and the state, the program that the state had helped them do that and did it quite effectively. The caution I would give in today's environment goes back to my gas tank metaphor. I'm kind of a guy of pictures. If you don't have enough gas in the engine, and the car is too heavy, that is, we've designed a thing that's too heavy for the gas that drives it, then the risk transfer mechanism won't work. And it doesn't matter whether it's 10%, well, it probably makes it better if it's 10% of the risk as opposed to 100% of the risk, but it makes it harder and harder for the organizations downstream to make their market work, because they have to go out and negotiate with the physicians and the hospitals. And in most of these cases, those negotiations are really brought about, what I would call in a high-spirited community kind of perspective. But at some point, if they can't make the market, then the state transfer of that risk doesn't work. I personally believe we're close to that, not just because of the amount of the funds in the gas tank, but I think there are also some larger risk selection having to do with how heavy the chassis is.
Representative Bates.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick comment and then a question for you. I think you're right, and we're close to the edge here. I believe Rite Aid is going to pull out of the Medicaid program within the next few days. We'll probably be seeing major advertisements. They don't think they can make it to AWP less 17. When that occurs, when Kaiser leaves the system, when large corporations choose to self-insure, that just takes the cost shift further of those that are still there. Which actually leads to my question. I haven't heard a discussion of a policy issue concerning the federal drawdown. In other words, the lack of money we're putting into the system prevents us from giving a drawdown. Ultimately, when you go through the whole shift, it leads to increased commercial cost, because they're the ones pick it up ultimately. It would seem logical to me that the commercial payers may want to look at some way of grabbing that federal drawdown if they can be sure they might get it. But I'd like to hear your comments on it.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bates, your term federal drawdown, I'm assuming, means that in the absence of a dollar invested by the state, we lose the federal match in the healthcare delivery system. And it's kind of a unique federal-state partnership, as opposed to if you take a dollar out of the general fund anyplace else, you don't necessarily lose a buck and a half. I think the issue, it's always been, I mean, the federal-state partnership has always been, Uncle Sam's got a really deep pocket because they don't have a constitutional obligation to balance the budget like we do. And it's always been the pressure, I think, not only in this state but in most states, is to be able to find the state wherewithal, the state sources of funding, to be able to go get the federal drawdown, whether it be under a waiver or whether it be under the classic Medicaid program. In fact, we've been quite creative over the years. Many of us in this room have been involved in various activities to try to bring new and different funding streams to the Oregon Health Plan, like tobacco tax, to take pressure off the general fund, because that was particularly true after Measure 5 and the new role the state played in funding public school, K through 12. I think the issue about I think what's in your question, Representative Bates, and I'm just going to go to it, and that is, if there were new creative ways to raise a dollar that went and got a dollar and a half, Wouldn't all of the stakeholders in healthcare, providers, insurers, purchasers, et cetera, see that as an advantage? And I think in a perfect world, my answer would be unabashedly and without hesitation, yes. The imperfections of the world that I'm aware of run something like this, and that is, who's going to get the $1.50 back, and how's it going to be seen, and will it be seen? So I think in theory, people readily understand that model. I think there's probably deep reservations about how it would work practically.
So this is Barney's world. I didn't think it was a good idea.
Well, Mr. Chair, this has been talked about, and the question is, what sort of certainty would there be that if the money would come back to where it was designed to over time? Also, simply because the legislature has been known to, over time, change its mind on things. And, those of us sitting here could agree to do something a certain way, and 10 years from now, or 5 years from now, a new legislative body that didn't have history and know all why say, well, there's some money, let's take it. So,
well, and Mr. Chair, Representative Cruz, that's actually a point second on my list. The first point was that, let's be hypothetical. There's 2% paid by ABC Plumbing to avert the cost shift. And over time, will ABC Plumbing see that 2% come back to them? They won't see it come back as a premium decrease, I doubt. What they'll see it come back as is a lower rate of increase.
Right.
All other things being equal. And it's the all other things being equal part that probably give the purchasers some heartburn.
I agree.
What gives the providers some heartburn on this front, Mr. Chair, Representative Cruz, is in fact your point, and that is, I think many of us, even in these hard times, while we would love to have dedicated funds, we still think that the funding of health care across the general fund is probably the fairest way for society to bear that burden, because every taxpayer is paying for it. Now, we've seen jump shifts and backfills having to occur, and I don't know whether that will change over time. But you're right. There are always higher needs in this building sometimes that have to be met.
Yeah, we have yet to be able to create an impenetrable box.
Not unless we go constitutionally.
That's right.
Is ABC Plumbing, is that professional slang for an internist?
I'd actually be a urologist, Mr. Chairman. But I was using that metaphor, Mr. Chair, to describe the purchaser community, not the provider community. But
okay. You're talking over my head again.
Well, that was amazing. They both went there at the same time.
I
was
pretty clever. Give each other the business.
To what extent are our policy or fiscal tools blunted by the federal waivers and / maintenance of effort issues?
Mr. Chair, Representative March, I'm going to have to answer that honestly. I don't know other than this. I think we have, as we work through this kind of process, we need to fully understand what the implications are, particularly in the very near term versus the longer term, about waiver requirements and maintenance of effort. And perhaps even, I guess, what possibility for flexibility in some sort of transition could we actually perhaps negotiate? The one thing I think that folks at OMAP and DHS would agree on, we're not the only state going through this. So increased flexibility seems to be possible, but you raise a very important externality test, kind of like the system of what does it do, the point I made about what does it do to the private system, is what flexibility losses do we incur because of existing waivers, and how do we manage that? Mr. Chair, I appreciate the committee's patience. I'll just conclude with my last slide, framing a new consensus. As I said on the Senate side, having been involved along with a lot of other people who are sitting behind me and many of you who have been in the legislature for a couple of sessions, it's one thing to work in a politics of expansion. It's another to work in a politics of contraction. It's a new game for those of us who are stakeholders, and it's clearly going to be a new game that you witness, because while I've never had a general election certificate on my wall, I've been told that it's much more fun to be a legislator in an era of politics of expansion. Unfortunately, we're not there today. I do want to make a point, though. Well, let me run through this, and then I'll kind of close with some ad libs. I think we do need to know the fiscal reality. The we, meaning not just you, you're going to get that as legislators, but I think we need to know, back to this, the stakeholder groups, how big's the box? What's the reality? There are going to be tough choices, and there are going to be tough priorities on the horizontal, on the vertical, and on the diagonal, and within this box. I'm going to throw out that, do we triage using vulnerabilities? And there are a number of vulnerabilities that can be taken into account. Historically, the Medicaid program has been built around economic vulnerability, along using the tool of the federal poverty level. But there are age, gender, and health status vulnerabilities that we've also recognized. For example, our support for pregnant women and kids goes up beyond 100, the required 133%, and goes higher for very good, I think, triage vulnerability issues that make sense both for the purchase of health care, but also state policy. I've talked about the impact of choices, and I would add to my list, and I thank Representative March, another one now, and that would be what's the nature of the federal partnership through waivers and things like that. Back to the real choices. I guess I've been around the Oregon political scene and the Oregon healthcare stakeholder scene long enough that while we're all going to have a very steep learning curve on this politics of contraction, I think that all of the organizations and people that I know are taking this quite seriously. We all have to look very seriously at our own organizational self-interest, but I also think that all of us have worked in the past together to know that there's a larger collective good to be had. And I also think there's an awareness that what we're going to have to do over the next few weeks and months isn't going to be fun. It's not going to be like 1989 or 93 when it was fun to put this map together. But we also have to be cognizant that we need to have a system standing at the end of the economic downturn that we can build on. And so I think part of the debate is going to be, you know, if you want to call it infrastructure or whatever you want to call it, we will come out of this, and we're managing the downside of this. And the contraction, there may be real contraction, but we also need to be prepared to think about when we come up the other side of the mountain, how are we going to build up on that other side relative to either populations or services or reimbursements or whatever. I don't have an answer. But I think that's another thing that for us to think about, and I've heard people talk about that very responsibly. It kind of comes out like this. I know I'm going to take a hit, but I also want to know, can we be part of positioning the state and our healthcare delivery and finance system with the state so that when we come out of this, we can come back to some of the core aspects of the Oregon Health Plan and preserve those so that we can move forward in the next boom economy. With that, Mr. Chairman, my prepared remarks are completed. I appreciate, again, your patience, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Patience, we appreciate your presence. Any additional questions for Mr. Spate regarding his presentation?
I do have a quick question.
Yep.
Thank you, Chair. Barney, we've heard a lot about costs of services the last few weeks. Now I think about the cost of an airline ticket, you know, being all over the place. Who's the right? Are the Price Waterhouse people the right people, the right folks to maybe bring in to talk about how costs are developed? Do you have thoughts on that you can quickly share? Or
PwC, when you, Mr. Chair, Mr. Bacobian, when you talk Price Waterhouse, you mean Price Waterhouse serving as a consultant to OMAP in the development of the rates? Yeah, I would say that. In fact, I was light evening reading. I was looking at the 2003 rate book that was published the other night, and they have a lot of assumptions in there regarding cost trends and the reasonableness of the rates that they develop and give to OMAP for the legislature to concern. And I would note that that's another statutory requirement that we need to be cognizant of, is a reasonableness of payment. And so you can look to them and Sandy and others for kind of the technical view of how did you get this to this rate to say that it was reasonable? What assumptions did you use? And you may have debates over that. I mean, that's why we have debating actuaries.
And we did because they came and presented before the Labor Steering Committee and we questioned some of the base assumptions, and clearly they were making assumptions out in space that they had no serious basis for. But it might be good to know the assumption base that they used to come to their conclusions, because you know it is in the finite universe they're dealing with.
Mr. Chair and Representative Cruz, one other point to that, and that is this is a very volatile environment that we're in right now. If you talk to any of the fully capitated health plans, looking at rates, looking at the assumptions about taking services out, what's left, and is there a new risk profile, and should the rate be adjusted upward, the cascading effect of all of these changes have made the volatility of this decision-making environment even higher. And I think everybody's concerned about that. I just pointed out that that's another factor that's different, because a lot of the rate development done 10 years ago was done in an environment where things were much more predictable,
stable,
both the revenue stream but also the external cost environment.
A couple little housekeeping issues here. I'd like to point out the importance of your graph and the fundamental requirement, Mr. Britton and Ms. Thorne and Lynn, wherever you are. John has joined us. He's in the back of the room. We need the baseline number to start building this thing up. He's going, I know, Ben, I know. And thanks for being here. Secondly, I introduced Mr. Spade as the director of government relations for Kaiser Permanente, and he is certainly all of that. He is not here today wearing Kaiser's hat. He is here of his 20-plus years. Well, he's been involved in healthcare public policy longer than I've been alive. Let me put it that way.
Right.
And
you ain't that young.
I ain't that old.
But I'm also very pleased to introduce Barney not only to the committee, but those in the audience who have been very diligent in their attendance as the facilitator for the Oregon Health Plan, the informal work group we've put together. We're going to be seeing a lot of Barney as he comes and reports to us on a...
And look how excited he looks.
He is thrilled. He's also going to sit on the mental health informal work group. I mean, as we all know, these overlap a great deal, and we're going to have to blend them together before we're able to get our recommendations down to the Ways and Means process. So, Barney, I don't know if you have any thoughts on this daunting task, but we are not only pleased to have you here today, we are proud to have you involved in the informal work group.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for those kind words. When I was asked, I said, you know, I'm here for I'm here to serve, and I'm here for the fellowship. It will be a daunting task. I think all of the people are going to be up to this. It's a tight timeline, and I hope with both working with you and Chair Cruz, Chair Winters, Mr. Bacobian, and others to be able to give periodic updates and bring to you some recommendations that the stakeholder group can support strongly. And hopefully that will help guide your decision-making.
Well, I think it's critical. Three members of this committee will sit on not only the OHP group, but the
mental health group as well. It's going to be a very intensive time. If anyone's listening that has myself, Representative Cruz, or Representative Bates on their evening schedule between February 17th and March 6th, just scratch them off right now, because we are going to be heavily involved for that entire period, trying to get our arms around parts of this solution. So,
and Mr. Chair, and then it gets real busy.
Yeah, and then it gets real busy after that. So we appreciate you. Thank you very much.
I think Representative Merkley had a question.
Well, my thank you, Representative Cruz and Mr. Chair. This may be a question to pursue at a later point in time, but you mentioned demographics in your presentation. And, you know, a lot has been made on Social Security, how when the system started you had 20 wage earners for each person drawing out, and we're going to be in a situation where there are going to be four people drawing out or something like that for each person paying in. Healthcare is, public health care is kind of in a similar situation. It's just much more complicated because the funds are taxes that go into the general fund and match Medicare, Medicaid. And because it's not just the age, it's not just the baby boomers, if you will, that receive benefits. But still, it seems like there must be a kind of a mother load of insight within those demographics as to how Oregon tax revenues could be affected as there are fewer earners, if you will, within the profile of the population, and greater demand with greater age. And if there's any materials you have that kind of help us understand, so we're not looking 1 year ahead, but thinking about what does it look like 10 years ahead, I think it would be helpful.
Mr. Chair, Representative Merkley, that's an excellent strategic question. And in fact, I'll do some checking. There has been some modeling done, and I believe Oregon participated in it, of looking at using some assumptions about age, employment rate, growth of average wage jobs, et cetera, of looking out, say, 10 or 20 years and understanding both the revenue picture and some of the, if you will, social service and other service demands on the system, and so you can think about this longer term. And I'll see if I can find – I've never seen the results, but I've heard of them, and I'll see if I can find them. They may be published now.
Thank you very much.
Okay.
Thanks.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any other questions coming before the committee? Seeing none, thanks, everybody, for being here. We are adjourned.